Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Cloud 259 running on air. It's Tuesday evening, August 6th. I'm Greg Lemelstein. I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones, and this is Lucky Episode 13. Bren, what's on tap for today?
Oh, we've got a fun episode tonight, Greg. For the warm-up, what we used to call the workout, we're going to call it the warm-up now. We're going to cover the world champs, give some of our highlights, what we're looking to see. After that, we've got the workout or the interview. When we started this show, we didn't realize we'd get such great people to interview. Now that we've got them, we're going to call this the workout. So tonight, we've got very special guest, somebody who ran in a high school in Rochester, New York, which is where I'm from, and who's running not only Worlds, but also the New York City Marathon this fall, and that's Jeff Eggleston. So we're really looking forward to talking to Jeffrey. Then we'll go to the elite scene, talk a little bit more about Moscow. We'll talk a bit about our training. We'll hit the library, where I will go to the photo section of the library and dig into the archives there. And then, Greg, on the soapbox, I think you're going to talk something called premium potties. So I'm a little afraid of what that's going to be about, but we'll see.
We'll save that one for the end. So, yeah, let's get warmed up about World Champs. It's just a few days away while we're taping this. It starts on Saturday, August 10th, with the Women's Marathon and some other big events. Just going to give some themes of things we're looking forward to, not go to absolutely every event, but just generally what I'm excited about is the U.S. medal hopes are really pretty high this year. If you look at the mid-distance and distance events, so that's 800 and up, including the 1,500, 5,000, 10,000, the steeple, and the marathon, the U.S. won two medals, men and women combined, at the London Games, and three in each of the last three world championships. Now, I think there's a very, very good chance we could well exceed that this year. There are a number of legit medal contenders in a number of events. We got Alicia Montano and Brenda Martinez in the 800, Jenny Simpson in the 1500, Shalane Flanagan in the 10,000. And then on the men's side, Nick Simmons and Dwayne Solomon are both threats in the 800. You can never count out Leo Manzano in the 1500. Perhaps Centrowitz will be there as well. Evan Jaeger is an up-and-comer in the steeple. And last but certainly not least, Galen Rupp in the 10,000. The other thing I wanted to keep an eye on, you know, everyone talks about Mary Kane. She'll be the focal point, as usual, as she should be. She's 17 years old, and she's a phenom. Potential long shot for a medal, but we'll have to watch. She's not the only teenage prodigy, though. You've also got 19-year-old A.J. Wilson running in the 800 for Team USA. There's the UK's Mary Kane, 18-year-old Jessica Judd of the UK, broke 200 just like Mary, and she'll be running. And then on the men's side, Hagos Geprewet is just 19. It's easy to forget, but he's one of Mo's biggest rivals in the 5,000. In the steeple, you've got Consuelos Caputo of Kenya. He's 19. And then 19-year-old Mohamed Amen in the 800. And then the last thing, number three, the theme that I'm looking forward to is Ethiopia versus Kenya. Always an interesting rivalry to watch. Now, Ethiopia really bombed out in the marathon at the London Games. None of their three runners finished the race. But this year, they are bringing the talented squad. They're bringing everything they have. Sege Kabidi, Lalisa Desisa, Feisa Lalisa, Tedessa Tola, and Tilahun Ragasa. Not so easy to say the names, but let me give you the times. These are their PRs. 204.38, 204.45, 204.52, 204.49, and Ragasa is the slowpoke with a 205.27 PR. So we'll see how they battle the Kenyans. The Kenyans seem to have great runners, but maybe not their A team.
Yeah,
so, Bren, you have some
rivalry.
Thoughts?
Big rivalry over there. You know, Greg, one guy you didn't mention as a medal hope who I'm really looking forward to seeing is Bernard Lagat. He's running the 5,000. You talked about some teenagers. Lagat is 38 years old, so he's pretty ancient as far as runners go, but he's pretty young from where I'm standing, so I'll be rooting for him. Lagat has actually done pretty well against Galen Rupp historically, and I think that, you know, he's a shot. He's got a shot. He's still got some skills in the 5,000. He didn't run that well recently, but he did win the U.S. Olympic trials in the heat. He's still got a kick, so look out for Lagat. Two other major points I'm looking forward to. One is the women's 800. We got Brenda Martinez running with Alicia Montano for the U.S., and they're going against the hometown hero of these games, Maria Savinova. So every Olympics has a hometown hero, I believe, that in Moscow they'll certainly be rooting for their gold medalist in the 800. So, as always in the women's 800 with Alicia Montano, you've got a contrast of styles any race she's in because you know she's going to take it out hard. Brenda Martinez, I believe, has actually been negative splitting some 800s recently, which is very unusual at the international level. So look for Alicia to take it out. I think look for Martinez to kind of track Savinova, who also is a bit of a sit and kicker. So it should be a very fun race to watch. Another major point I'll mention is just that Mo Farah, who, of course, got the double in the Olympics last year in the 5,000 and 10,000, is going for the double-double. He's going to try to get the double again in the 5,000 and the 10,000. The last time this was done was not too long ago, but it was certainly a legend of the track. Kenenisa Bekele in 2008 won the 5,000 and 10,000 in the Olympics at Beijing, and in 2009 repeated the feat in Berlin. Legat, who I just mentioned earlier, he actually doubled in 2007 at the Worlds, not in the 5 and the 10, though, in the 15 and in the 5. In Legat's double there, an 18-year-old named Asbel Kiprop came in fourth in that 1500. Kiprop now, of course, is the favorite in the 1500. And a guy named Mo Farah came in sixth in the 5000 that Legat won in 2007. So we've heard about Mo too. Finally, on the cloud here, we of course will be tracking the people that we have had as guests. Jeanette Faber joined us in episode 10, Dot McMahon in episode 12. Both will be running the marathon for the women, which is August 10th. The men's marathon is August 18th, and we're thrilled tonight that we'll be speaking to one of the guys who will be running the marathon. And Greg, I say don't count him out for a medal either. Tonight's guest is Jeffrey Eggleston. Greg, tell us a bit about Jeffrey.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're so pleased to have him, and the marathon is our focus, so we'll be rooting hard for the marathoners anyway, but having them on the show makes it extra special. Just a little bit about Jeffrey. He's leading the men's marathon team for the race, which is just a little over a week away on August 17th. Jeffrey has a 2:12:03 marathon PR, which he set in Chicago last fall, where he was second American. He has been ranked as high as fourth in Track and Field News rankings of U.S. marathoners, and this will be his second time representing the USA at Worlds. And he's also a little bit of a crazy man, having run as many as 4 marathons in 8 months last year. He's joining us from Boulder, Colorado. Jeffrey Eggleston, welcome to the cloud.
Hi, Greg. Hi, Bren. Thank you. Thank you guys so much for having me on the show. I'm really happy to be here. And just one quick correction. The men's marathon is August 17th, not 18th.
Yeah, sorry about that. Got it right.
Oh,
Greg,
definitely got to get that right.
We want you to go on the wrong day.
we don't want anyone
know when it is.
we don't want anyone to miss that. So
yeah,
speaking of the race, how has your training been in preparation for Moscow? Are you tapering yet? Are you packing your bags yet?
A little bit of everything. Training has been going great. I'm just beginning to scale back my total volume for getting ready for the marathon. Tomorrow is my last important workout. I usually always do something about 10 days out from the race. And so, I have an important workout to get through tomorrow. And then I've pretty much jumped the last hurdle, and then it's really just kind of running by feel from now until the race, and just giving myself some time to recover, go through super compensation, and then obviously get to the race and travel. And I'll be leaving next Monday on the 12th. So I'll get over there, I think probably Tuesday, because you lose a day in travel. But, I'm ready to go, and I'm really happy with how things have gone the past 15 weeks here in Boulder. So I'm very excited.
That's terrific. And what's the workout tomorrow that you have to get through?
Tomorrow I'm doing a specific marathon block. So in the morning I'm going to warm up, and then I'm going to do 10K moderate. And, we're up at elevation here. Give myself a little bit of time, and then I'm going to go into 12K at marathon pace and just run marathon pace here, even though we're at 5,000 feet. And then I get a little bit of a break. I get to rest up in the afternoon. And then when I come back, I'm going to do 10K moderate again in the evening. And then I'm going to do 4 times 3K with 3 minutes recovery. And so with all, you know, total volume will cover, it'll be about 45K tomorrow or 50K tomorrow maybe. So.
Wow. And what's your peak mileage been like per week?
Peak volume probably around, I want to say maybe 140 to 150 miles.
Mm-hmm.
And really the emphasis has, you know, just been on quality. And, you know, my long days are long. My recovery days are really easy. So it's not about getting out there and running, you know, a solid, you know, 20, 25 miles a day. It's, you know, some days are longer, some days are shorter. You know, there's definitely a dynamic that I go through with mileage. And really when I, you know, kind of lay out my training plan, and we can go into this in more detail, it, you know, the emphasis definitely, you know, as we get closer to the race, it's more on a specific, you know, intensity and endurance, you know, focus for the marathon. And so the more time I spend at a specific pace in the marathon is more important than the you know, the total volume that I'm putting in.
Right, right. We'll get back maybe a little bit to training later on, but what are your goals for Moscow?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, you know, this is my second world championship experience, and, you know, I really want to redeem myself for, you know, my performance in Daegu. I was 39th, and it was a really disappointing experience for me, and I can't really explain why or how, you know, in all detail what exactly went wrong in Daegu, because, you know, I felt my training was going great leading up to that point. And, you know, I just run 2:13 in grandma's, and, you know, 3 months later I felt like I was in better shape. But I think this time around I kind of understand that going into a world championship, there are a lot of variables. You can have great training and a great build-up, but you still got to go into the race with your guard up and, you know, just kind of run a smart tactical race. And you're really just trying to capitalize on my fitness, you know, on that day. And so, you know, definitely if I can improve on Daegu, which is kind of a, you know, low-hanging fruit at this point, that would be great.
How is it different, though? Like, how is it different from, a, you know, say a big city marathon?
Well, I mean, definitely you eliminate, you know, in all races except, like, New York City Marathon, for example, you don't have pacers. So, you know, the race is governed basically by, you know, whatever athletes decide to take it out. And you know, in a lot of these world championships, they go out pretty fast and they sustain a pretty, you know, high intensity the whole way. So, you know, I'm not worried about whether or not the race is going to be too fast. But, you know, I definitely, you know, conditions permitting, you know, we're going to be running at 3:30 in the afternoon in Moscow, and looking at the weather right now, it, you know, it could be nice, it could be humid, it could be rainy, it could be a little bit warm. You know, we don't quite know yet, but really it's just trying to run, for me, it's, you know, it's about running the best tactically, you know, smart race. And, you know, if I can run a personal best, I'd be extremely happy. And, you know, that's what championship races are about, too. It's just about getting out there and competing. And, you know, there are a lot of scalps I want to take if, you know, if I run the right race tactically for myself. So, you know, I think those are my big goals going into Moscow next week.
Now, have you spoken with your teammates Carlos Trujillo and Daniel Tapia? And by the way, I believe Daniel Tapia is taking the bar exam early this week, maybe today. He was a late entry into the field after Mo Trafa was pulled out with an injury. Have you spoken with them, or will you speak with them once you're in Moscow?
As of now, I haven't spoken with either specifically about the race. You know, I know Carlos a little more well than Mo or Daniel, who's replacing him now. So Carlos and I have been in touch a few times, and, you know, it's just nice to touch base. And obviously, I was really happy for him to have this experience, to be able to, you know, run in a world championship team too. But, you know, given the circumstances that, you know, we're all from different training groups, and, you know, the IAAF has eliminated the team competition. You know, there's no team cup this year. It kind of makes it a scenario where it's more of every man for himself out there. But, you know, that being said, you know, I'm really excited for both Carlos and Daniel. And, you know, if they're in the race and in similar circumstances, you know, we're wearing the same uniform, so we're definitely going to, you know, work together. But at this point in time, you know, like, there's not really too much to talk about tactically or, you know, just about the race, other than, you know, we're just, all three of us are going to give it our best effort, and I know that's going to happen.
You know, it's interesting that you have the lead, the best PR of the Team USA, because we had on the show Patrick Rizzo a number of episodes ago, and he went into London gunning for your time, looking to get in the top three. And little did he know that he could have had a run a slower time and still made Worlds. I don't think he would have run it any other way, knowing Patrick from the interview.
Right.
He probably would have run it the same way. But, you know, it kind of begs the question that the U.S. really has the opportunity to be sending five marathoners rather than three. And I wonder if you had any thoughts about that.
Yeah, well, and, you know, that's an interesting point you brought up about Patrick. And obviously I know him well from you know, when we were both teammates and living together in Michigan, and now that we're, you know, both out in Boulder, of course. But, you know, there was uncertainty for me to make the team, you know, even at the beginning of this year. And, you know, I definitely felt the pressure just as Rizzo did, and I'm sure as, you know, a myriad of other athletes in the U.S. did, where, you know, I really was hoping this spring to go chase a better time to secure my spot on the team. I mean, it was pretty clear from USATF that they were going to send three athletes and that, you know, to really be in consideration. And, you know, we clearly knew when the window was. It was going to be from October to, you know, April or to the end of or beginning of May. So, you know, we kind of knew what our time window was and we kind of knew where we'd fit into that context. So, I mean, personally, I'm okay with, you know, having three athletes versus five. I definitely don't understand how having two more additional athletes would be detriment, you know, to having, you know, to adding them to the roster. And, I, you know, it's a great experience for developing athletes to get out there to, you know, put on a USA jersey and represent our country. But, I mean, that being said, too, you know, also being on a USA team, it means that you're the upper echelon in your discipline. And the point of, you know, trying to earn that selection is to truly be, you know, at the top of your discipline. It's a little bit different, of course, you know, with the marathon because, you know, there are a lot of conflict of interest. There are a lot of, you know, marathons and, you know, athletes can be in good shape or there can be injuries. You can run in different conditions. So there are definitely more variables in that selection process. I guess in hindsight, I think maybe the, you know, like looking at how the team was selected this year, I would have been totally fine with the window being larger for selection. So maybe going back to, you know, Olympic trials performances in Houston in 2011, because, you know, that race indicated that we have really good depth in the marathon. And, you know, I could realistically see, you know, sending three 2:11 marathoners to the world championships that would really want to do it. So, but, you know, based on the criteria and we all knew what it was, you know, I feel kind of lucky and fortunate that, you know, things have gone the way they have. And, you know, I've earned this opportunity and I, you know, just plan to capitalize on it.
I guess you're at an advantage if you think of it in terms of a career, in that you are unafraid of running a lot of marathons. And so it's not like this is a lost opportunity. Running Worlds is a lost opportunity to make some money running a fall marathon. In fact, you recently it was announced you're running the New York City Marathon this fall. So, so why did you decide on the Big Apple over Chicago, where you did so well last year?
You know, that's a great question. And for me, it really wasn't necessarily a decision of, you know, after Worlds is over with. And obviously, Worlds is a huge focus for me. And, you know, I'm not holding back so I can, you know, go to a fall marathon later on. But
right.
It also wasn't necessarily a decision of, you know, New York versus Chicago. There are a lot of races that, you know, are great opportunities, you know, marathons especially, you know, in the fall. That there are some great, you know, viable options. Obviously, 8 weeks after Worlds is the Medtronic Twin Cities Marathon. You know, incidentally, that's the U.S. Championships this year. So that was one that was, you know, I was highly considering for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, my track record, you know, I've had experiences running marathons close together. And, you know, I've been able to, you know, I stand behind my results. They've been pretty good being able to do a marathon, you know, or two marathons of a month in between or so. But with my consideration final decision to do New York City, you know, it just came down to me believing that, you know, at this point in my career, I really want to swing for the fence each time I go out for a marathon. And, you know, there's the optimal time between Moscow and in August and New York City and, you know, the beginning of November where, you know, I can give myself adequate recovery,
right.
And then, you know, time to really prepare and, again, just try to swing for the fence. And Moscow is a big stage, and New York City is a big stage. I mean, those are probably the two, I mean, for at least 2013, those are the two biggest marathon stages in the world. And I feel really fortunate to be able to run both of them. And, you know, it requires a lot of preparation and a lot of, you know, just a good build-up. And I want these two marathons to be marathons I can be proud of.
Have you watched the New York Marathon before from the city, or have you run part of the course before?
I've never run the course. Well, actually, I think back in 2008, I ran the New York City Half Marathon. And so I ran part of the course. I ran through Central Park, you know, the rolling hills, and
right.
And then back into Battery Park. But I think, you know, the New York City Marathon never really caught my attention until probably when I was in high school. You know, I grew up in Rochester, New York, so it's not that far away from the race. But, you know, as I started getting into distance running, I think probably 2002 was the year I really, you know, started noticing the marathon and being like, hey, these guys can run pretty fast. And I do have the distinct memory of watching Rogers Ropp win in 2002. And personally, he's one of my idols growing up in you know, in the marathon, because, you know, he won Boston and New York in the same year, and that was really incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you know, obviously when you're a high schooler, it's hard to fathom running a marathon. It's hard, you know, you run the 3,200, you don't think about 26.2 miles, but...
Yeah, incidentally, that was the first marathon I ran, was that 2002 Rogers Ropp win. That was a cool race.
It was awesome, and, you know, like, I was just really impressed, and maybe I just didn't understand the culture of marathoning. I didn't understand, you know, which athletes would be the top athletes, but for whatever reason, like, that just sticks in my mind, and I mean, I was impressed, and it even kind of fired me up and thought, well, hey, you know, what if one day I run a marathon? But, I mean, that took many, many years to realize later on.
Well, you know, before the show, I was doing some research on Jeffrey, and I'm from Rochester, New York, too, and interestingly, we ran on some of the same courses in high school. I noticed that the McQuaid Invitation, you spotted a time of around 15:01 or something, which struck me as a fairly good race. But, I mean, you were very strong in high school. You did some running at Virginia, I understand, but it wasn't until after high school and college that you really caught the world's attention, I suppose. So was it a surprise to you when it seemed like this could be a career or you could make a living doing this?
You know, that's a good question. And, I mean, there was just always kind of an enjoyment with running since high school. And I think there were some, you know, some flashes in moments, at least in high school, where I thought, like, hey, you know, I could be really good at this if I continue to pursue it. But I think after college and just having that individual focus and just putting in the consistent miles and the training, and I think I really enjoy it outside of a team atmosphere. I think I'm just better able to direct myself when I'm doing my own training. And so I think, like, you know,
well,
I kind of expected, well, I don't know, but I don't know the whole situation, but
right.
I think for me personally, you know, I've just continued to improve each year. And I think on my own, I never put a limit on what I could do. And there were definitely some surprises and some breakthroughs along the way that were great. But also at the same time, I felt like, wow, this is a long time coming, or, you know, I've been doing this consistently for so long that, you know, it's like, if you put the work in over time, eventually you reap the benefits of it. And sometimes you just don't know when it's going to finally catch up with you and, you know, when you'll make that big jump. So,
now one race,
I mean,
one race from your career that I'm very interested in was the 2011 Pittsburgh Marathon. I was trying to piece this together. You were hired as a rabbit, and you ended up winning the race. And also in the race clips that I saw from YouTube, you were actually trailing the leaders. So you were rabbiting some runners who were behind, is that right?
Right. So, you know, so I was brought in by Pittsburgh race organizers to help. This was the year leading up to the Olympic trials for the marathon. And
right.
So they, you know, Pittsburgh did an awesome job. They wanted to, you know, kind of give some incentives and sweeteners for athletes hoping to qualify for the trials by doing it at their race. And to help facilitate that, they brought me in as a pacemaker, you know, to run the 218 that they, you know, the required time to get into the trials. So I had a couple American athletes I was pacing. Actually, one of them, you know, just Swiss citizenships, Boaz Chebuo. And so, yeah, so for the majority of the race, and, you know, there really wasn't much pressure on me because I was just supposed to run, you know, what was it, 518 or 520 per mile and, you know, help pace Boaz. And, you know, they did give me the option. They said, you know, if after 18 miles you want to, you know, or 30K, you want to continue and finish the race, you know, you can do that. If not, you can just drop out and, you know, you got your workout in and you know, like, that's just the end of your duty for the day. And so
you're
I really
sort of on a leash for 18 miles.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, like for a lot of the race, I didn't really even pay attention to where any of the leaders or where anyone else was, because I was like, okay, you know, we're running 5:18 pace with Boaz and, you know, he's feeling okay. And I mean, really my focus was just kind of on helping the, you know, the guys who were trying to get that 218. Now, that being said, you know, like, Pittsburgh's a pretty tough course. It's pretty hilly. There are some sections where you can run a lot faster. There's some sections where, you know, you can run a lot slower because you're climbing. So, you know, it's a challenging course to kind of set that steady pace that, you know, some of the trials hopefuls really needed. But, you know, when we got to the 18-mile point and, you know, my duties were done with, you know, there's no conflict of interest because I just, you know, I did what I was supposed to do first, and then, you know, I looked up the road, and I saw the leaders were there, and, I mean, gosh, I felt pretty good, and, you know, at that point, you know, I didn't want to drop out, and I thought, well, you know, hey, what the heck, why not give it a try, and, I mean, you know, obviously, when you're in pretty good shape and able to run a 212 or a 213, you know, running 218 pace isn't going to hurt you so bad, and so, you know, there's a lot left in the tank.
Right.
And, I mean, it worked out. I mean, you know, on other days, maybe I could have finished second. Maybe I would have finished third. There were still some, you know, some very good international athletes in the race. But
how did Boaz end up finishing that race?
I think he faded pretty badly to 222 or 223. He was having a problem with his hamstring because of the hills.
Mm-hmm. Got
so,
it. So when at the time at 18 miles when you were still feeling good, was he still running with you or was he shot at that point?
He was kind of yo-yoing, you know, going back and forth. But I didn't say like, hey, I see the leaders up the road, you know, I'm going
right.
to pick it up.
Right.
Because really my commitment is to him. And, you know, if he needs me to go grab his water, I'll go grab his water. I mean,
right.
it's not a big deal for me. But once that was done with, and I made sure, you know, once we're through 18 miles and, you know, I didn't want to mess up anybody's race. I mean, if Boaz was right on my heels and really needed the help, you know, then that would be, you know, me staying with him. But,
right.
you know, it's just kind of like things just had to align properly that day. And for whatever reason, you know, I had the opportunity to go up and challenge the leaders and feel good enough to come out the victor. And, it was a good it gave me some confidence. It made me believe, like, you know, this is the right event for me. And,
right.
you know, you learn a lot about racing when you're in a circumstance like that. You know, obviously 216 is not a very good time, but, you know, the way we ran it and, you know, it was like surge after surge once I came into the lead because, you know, these guys turn around and they're like, hey, you know, where did this guy come from? And so it's, you know, me pushing the pace and, you know, trying to throw some curveballs at them to really make them, you know, to work. And I think also too, like, that has a mental toll on your competitors. And like I said, for whatever reason, it worked out. And gosh, I mean, it made a great story, I guess. So
yeah.
how far would you say you were behind the leaders at mile 18? Was it about a minute or was it longer?
I'd say probably about a minute. I mean, like, you know, I definitely saw some, you know, like at that point in the race, you see athletes that are casualties from a lead pack come back to you. And so, you know, first it's one, then it's two, and then you just see a group up ahead, and you're like, oh, maybe that's the lead group. And then when you get close enough, you see the, you know, like the media truck, and you're like, well, that's the front of the race. And so, you know, that was pretty exciting for me, and I think that kind of gave me the momentum because I totally didn't expect it. where, you know, once I caught up to the leaders, actually the first thing I did when I got up to the leaders was I threw in a hard 1 minute surge. Because everyone looked around, they saw me, I saw the press truck, and I was like, well, I'm going to just go for it, you know, at, you know, 19 and a half or 20 miles and see what these guys can do. And, but yeah, I mean, I honestly don't know if, you know, at 18 miles, I wasn't sure where they were, you know, if it was that close where, you know, they were in striking distance.
Speaking of surges, another race we wanted to talk about was more recently, just a couple months ago, you won the Chicago Half Marathon in 105.41. Were you, mm-hmm. by the way, were you running that at sort of a marathon training pace, or were you running it at all out?
It, you know, that's a good question. I think it's probably between the two. I mean, definitely, you know, when I'm going into a marathon, in the last, I think the last three or four marathons I've done, I've gone out in about 105.30, and or, you know, trying to go for that 2:11 or maybe sub 2:11 pace, and you know, just put it out there. For this race, it was pretty warm in Chicago and humid. And, I mean, obviously the first thing is, you know, this is an opportunity to whet my competitive appetite, to get some racing experience in before world championships. So I kind of let, you know, what the other athletes were doing early on dictate my pace. I mean, definitely, you know, with a 103.50 PR, or, you know, I think I can go a little bit faster, and I feel pretty good about my shape right now, where maybe I could even do a half PR, you know, on the right course and the right conditions. But that being said, the conditions are pretty tough out there, and, you know, sometimes running 4:55 to 5 minute pace can feel tough. I mean, it definitely felt harder running out there than, you know, when I was running in Chicago last October for the marathon, and mm-hmm. I think it split 105.27 through the half.
Wow.
But I think the important part about that race, and I went into it knowing it, and, you know, I came out of it, you know, pretty pleased with the effort, and, you know, the emphasis was all on effort and, you know, just putting a good hard effort out there. And usually about, you know, 4 to 6 weeks out from, well, 4 or 5 weeks out from a marathon, I'll say, I do like to get out there, run the prescribed marathon pace that I, you know, I'm hoping to achieve in the race. And, you know, like I can, you know, in at sea level, or, you know, even at a little bit of elevation, run, you know, 4:58 to 5 minute pace and try to sustain that for 13 to 15 miles. And, you know, that's what I did in some heat and humidity in Chicago. So I felt pretty good about it.
And so you put in a big surge for the win, pulling ahead of a Kenyan who was running with you.
Right.
And you
yeah.
said afterwards that you wanted, love the quote. You said, I wanted to give fans a chance to see USA pull away from Kenya. So,
yeah.
But I just want, it makes me wonder, do you think American runners are sometimes intimidated by the Kenyans or Ethiopians?
I don't know if, it, you know, I can't speak for all Americans and, you know,
right.
many runners, it just depends. But, you know, I can say in, you know, in the circumstance in Chicago, I, you know, that part of the course was where I really wanted to put a surge to, you know, make the race exciting. And so, you know, I really wanted to make it as exciting as possible for the athletes out there. And, you know, I can say, you know, I definitely know my place, you know, when I line up in, you know, the world championships against, you know, you guys named, you know, between 204 and 206 marathoners. I know it's a long shot to try to compete against those guys when you're at 212. And so, you know, USA pulling away from Kenya might be a little bit more difficult in Moscow than it is in Chicago. But that being said, I, you know, I go into every race now, you know, not putting any athlete on a pedestal and saying they're unbeatable. I mean, obviously I can only control my race and what I'm doing tactically. And, you know, in some cases, you know, it's just like closing the margin that I'm defeated by in some races. But in other cases, you know, I mean, the two athletes, you know, there are two athletes in Chicago that, you know, in their careers, they have run probably between 62 and 63 minutes. And, you know, on any given day, they could beat me. And, you know, my goal was to beat them and put as much time between me and them as I could. And, you know, that was pretty successful. But I think it's just important. And, you know, I think there are a lot of, you know, other intrepid Americans now that, you know, aren't afraid to mix it up against international competition. And
is there a single race that you're most proud of so far in your career?
A single race, it, you know, I think I've, each race I've done, I, you know, or at least with the marathons I've done, I think each race I've become marginally more proud about, you know, how I've handled it and, you know, carried myself. I mean, obviously Chicago is my personal best, so I can't be, you know, displeased with that race. I mean, there are definitely some areas in that race where I felt, you know, there were some lapses of attention and, you know, maybe, you know, I didn't push hard enough, or maybe I settled, or, you know, vice versa. But, you know, obviously I'm proud any time I can, you know, win a race. And, you know, Pittsburgh, like we mentioned, is one of those once-in-a-lifetime opportunities where, you know, you're not even planning to complete the race and you win the race. But, I mean, there's just, I mean, each race that I've, you know, done probably in the past year or so, I've been really happy with how I've made progress. And even this year in April, I did the Paris Marathon, and maybe not under the best circumstances for me personally, where, you know, I had an injury problem going into, you know, like starting in the winter, and kind of an abbreviated buildup for the race. But I still went out there and I laid it on the line. I went through and won a 5:20, and, you know, I paid for it. I ran, I think, maybe an 8:30 final mile to run, you know, 2:14. But, I'm proud that, you know, even if it wasn't my day, I just toughed it out. And and so, you know, every race I'm just learning so much from. And, you know, every race is valuable for that, because I carry all those experiences with me. So in Moscow, I know, you know, I have at least one or two marathons to call on, you know, where I've experienced some type of discomfort, or, you know, something that, you know, I've already had it before. So it helps me a lot.
Well, you're very consistent. You have 7, I believe, sub-2:15s in the last 3 years. Mm-hmm. And we talked about how you race a lot. Can you just tell us you also wrote a piece on this in Runner's World, and we'll put a link on our site to it, about, you call yourself a serial racer. So what does that give you, just terms of your performance?
Well, I think I kind of received the title rather than, you know, proclaims being a serial racer.
Right, but, that was the headline. That's right. Not.
Yeah. But I think the concept, you know, the concept of serial racing, and, you know, there's a different spectrum of it. You know, obviously there's Yuki Kawuchi, you know, able running 208, 210, 209 in a month. And then, you know, maybe I'm putting, you know, a couple 213s together, or 214 and a 213 together in a month. And, but really what it's come down to is, you know, I don't know if I'm the optimal serial racer, or, you know, if I'm doing something that's really non-conventional, but really just kind of at this point, you know, listening to my body. And there's sometimes where I feel great after a marathon and, you know, recovery goes well, and I think, you know, I can give it another shot. And then there are other times where, you know, shoot, I'm just really out of commission, and, you know, I need to take a break from running marathons, or, you know, give myself some recovery or do some shorter races. But, I mean, you know, like I said, I'll let my track record speak for itself. And, you know, I've been running marathons since 2010. And, you know, in 2010, I only ran 2 marathons, and, you know, I ran 2 2:14s. And, at the same time, you know, at my level where maybe, you know, it's pretty lucrative if you do well in a couple of marathons, you know, financially, that can really change your situation if you're, you know, if you're not under a shoe contract, or, you know, not like with a, you know, a salary from, you know, a sponsorship. So, I mean, that being said, you know, there are some times where it's possible and other times where it's not. And I think at this point in my career, you know, I'm 28 years old, and I think my goals are now getting to, you know, approaching, you know, a respectable time in the marathon, where maybe I have to scale back on the, you know, the quantity of performances to focus on the quality.
So does most of your income come from race winnings? You do have a relationship with Marathon Guide, Brooks Power Bar, and also with NYAC, the club here in New York. Most of your income is from winnings?
Yeah, well, it depends on the year, but I'd say it's about, you know, 2/3 of, you know, my means of support come from, you know, what I'm able to, you know, achieve in, you know, 2 or 3 marathons a year. But I do have a great amount of foundational support from, you know, marathonguide.com, from, you know, Brooks from New York Athletic Club and Power Bar, of course. And, you know, they provide me with the resources that just enable me to, you know, carry on in training and you know, really make the commitment to the sport. But at this point in time, and, you know, for a 212 marathoner, you know, appearances are pretty rare. It's really performance-based and you know, all the more necessity for me to go and try to run, you know, some good quality performances because, you know, that helps me, you know, sustain myself as an athlete. And, you know, I can, at this point, I consider it a career. And, you know, to be professional and, you know, you have to be able to, you know, not lose money at the end of the year. So
we sometimes talk on the show about the value of a minute to a marathoner. In your case, 2 minutes and 3 seconds. Would a sub 210 change the dynamic for you, the financial opportunities or some other type of performance?
In some cases, yes. You know, I've thought about this more and more in the past year because, you know, in my last few marathons, I've gone out with, you know, it's trying to run 2:11 or 2:10 and try to hang on to this, you know, 65 minutes through half marathon. But also there's a realization now that the marathon has changed. The whole, you know, I mean, maybe not in the U.S., maybe, I mean, definitely in the U.S. There's more depth, but, you know, it's usually just a couple marathoners that in the U.S. that will dip under 2:10 each year. But, in the grand scheme of things, it's hard to say whether or not running 2:10 or a sub 2:10 would, you know, be a life-changing, you know, performance for me. Because on the other hand, you know, each year in Dubai, you have, you know, three or four athletes going under, you know, 2:05 or 2:04. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there's a gap between them and us. And,
mm-hmm.
and you know, given the economy with a lot of the, you know, shoe companies, it's, you know, it's hard for to, you know, to market yourself as a, you know, a 2:12 or a 2:11 or 2:10 athlete. And,
mm-hmm.
but, I mean, obviously, you know, at this point, I just focus on continuing to improve. You know,
right.
Since 2010, when I started, each year I've taken, you know, 70 to 80 seconds off my marathon time each year. So, I can't complain. I'm heading in the right direction, and you know, whether or not that lands me some, you know, financially, you know, life changing experience or not, you know, that's yet to be seen. And on the other hand, you know, if you win a U.S. title and you know, in 2010, you know, it took 2:14 to win the U.S. title. You can, you know, win $25,000. So that's, it's so arbitrary. Like, you can have a life-changing experience in the marathon and run 2:14. So it's,
mm-hmm.
you got to pick your races correctly too, I guess.
Now you do your own, marketing, I guess, of yourself. You don't have an agent and you don't have a coach, but I was just wondering if you had any thoughts on how the business model or the marketing of sport could be improved?
You know, that's a really good question. And I think a lot of athletes and agents are, you know, really trying to address that. And it's been a problem for a long time. And, you know, it just stems from the fact that, you know, there's not a lot of interest in, you know, in distance running. Or, I mean, maybe it's improving now, but, you know, you go to Europe and, you know, like when I went to the Paris Marathon, for example, and, you know, looking at the crowd support for the race and, you know, the amount of people out there and, you know, just like the appreciation of, you know, really quality performances. And then in the U.S., I mean, I don't think there's as much of a fan base for distance running. I mean, it's definitely improved over the years. And I think, you know, that starts with, you know, athletes that are in high school and, you know, getting more people involved in the sport to begin with, because, you know, if you're involved in the sport, then you kind of follow it and you can see it from, you know, anywhere from the amateur to professional level. You know, I don't know if I necessarily have any criticism of the business model. I would say, you know, there are some things that do hurt our sport where, you know, if there's restrictions on the amount of sponsorships, you know, that we can have or display on our uniform or, you know, things that will just make it difficult and less likely for, you know, sponsors and companies that, you know, could potentially help our sport, you know, they're not going to want to invest because, you know, how is their investment realized?
Right.
So, You know, I'm a big fan of watching the Tour de France every year in the summer. You know, that gets me fired up when I'm getting ready for a fall marathon. And, you know, you see all those sponsors all over their, you know, the team jerseys, and you know the teams by the sponsors' names. And, I mean, even if you could just implement a little bit of that in, you know, the professional side of running, you know, I think it would be great for, you know, supporting the athletes, and maybe it would generate the same type of buzz that, you know, running gets, you know, worldwide in other countries.
Mm-hmm. One thing that we found very interesting about you is that you're a vegan. So we just wanted to ask.
Well, I was a vegan.
Okay.
I'm no longer.
Okay. So now you have the paleo diet, or what have you got?
No, I you know, one thing I'll always learn is, you know, just maybe not about running, but anything else, is everything in moderation. And,
right.
And really, you know, in 2010, I experimented with being vegan, and, you know, I had some great results, and, you know, it came just kind of out of a personal curiosity for me to try to get my nutrients from, you know, plant-based sources. And, you know, I think there were a lot of positive things that really came out of it. You know, it just opened me up to trying a variety of different foods that I wouldn't necessarily try, you know, lots of different vegetables. And so I think that was great. And it made me more aware of, you know, what levels of nutrients I need. You know, like, as a vegan, you have to, you know, really be careful about your iron levels. You have to be careful about, you know, your B vitamins. And so I think it was a really good way for me to learn a little bit about nutrition and, you know, what my body really needs, and, you know, spending the extra time to make sure I get these nutrients, or else, you know, you have some pretty bad effects, you know, if you're deficient. But I, you know, I was a vegan for probably about a year and a half. And I think the thing that made me switch the most was actually, you know, when I was in Daegu, I had a really difficult time finding foods that were, you know, vegan friendly. You know, mm-hmm. a lot of things had fish in them, and, you know, and at that point, when you're traveling internationally, you don't want to limit your diet to the point where, you know, it might not be, you know, reasonable to be able to get the correct nutrients. And especially before a race, you know, it's really important that you're fueling properly and all your stores are topped off. So, you know, I didn't totally abandon being vegan, because, you know, there are a lot of things I like about it. And, you know, I love kale. I eat kale at least once a week. And, you know, quinoa is a great, you know, super grain to mix with anything. But I think also at the same time, you know, I'm just trying to be realistic about, you know, when I'm going to races and you know, when I'm training hard, I just want to make sure I'm getting the right nutrients. But I think it was a really great educational process for me. I don't necessarily recommend that every runner goes through a period of, you know, being vegan or, you know, detoxing themselves. But I definitely would say, like, it's really important when you're, you know, when you're pushing your body at a certain level, you know, through marathon training or for running, to, you know, take that initiative and really learn about what you're fueling your body with, and, you know, take the time to learn to make a, you know, a variety of different foods to help fuel yourself.
And, you know, you mentioned that it was a struggle in Daegu. Did nutritional issues, do you think, play a role in your race there, or was that?
I'll say possibly, but I'm not going to hide behind it and say that, you know, because, you know, I ate kimchi for, you know, 10 days in a row, it, you know, impacted my race. But,
right.
You know, I will say, like, well, that was my choice. And, you know, maybe that was a poor choice, you know, nutritionally, but, you know, before leading up to the race. I mean, definitely in Daegu, you know, I missed a couple bottles while I was out there running, and it was really humid. And, you know, if you don't replace your electrolytes, I think, you know, that can really be detrimental to your performance.
Right,
But, you know, what it makes me realize and in going forward is, like, you don't need to make it harder on yourself than it needs to be, you know, by putting yourself on some type of restrictive diet, especially if there's no allergy, if there's no, you know, there's no reaction that, you know, requires you to, you know, omit something from your diet. But, I mean, it's going to be a different story, too, going to Moscow. And I definitely plan to bring a lot of my own foods, too, just so I have things that I've, eaten before races and eaten before training that, you know, I know are comfortable. I bring plenty of power bars with me and, you know, things to fuel myself and, you know, just type off my glycogen storage, you know, before the race. So.
Well, we can't wait to watch you in the race. Sometimes it's difficult to see beyond the lead pack, but we'll try as hard as we can to track your performance and see you on the race. But we do have.
I think
a,
you're going to surprise them like you did in Pittsburgh.
right.
Yeah.
We're not counting you out, certainly.
I really look forward to it, and just keep hoping if I can run my run my best race, you know, I think I can do pretty well in those circumstances. So.
Do you have any, I know that your goal is generally to redeem yourself in your mind anyway from Daegu, where you finished 39th. Do you have any general time or place sort of targets or, you know?
Definitely, to be in the top 15 or top 20 would be awesome. I won't rule out anything, and it's hard to say because we don't have a full start list, so we can't really analyze, what athletes are running, what their personal bests are, when did they set that personal best, and what type of shape they're in now. So there are a lot of variables, but, obviously to be top 20 or top 15 in a world championship is a pretty good result, and obviously that's better than the 39th place that I had in Daegu. So, I'll kind of look to do that and, hope to be in the mix there and maybe I'll find myself late in the race if I'm running well, maybe moving into one of those spots, and I'd be quite pleased. In terms of a time goal, it's really difficult knowing, what our conditions were going to be up against with the 3:30 start time. In Boulder, it's been 90 degrees almost every day or, every other day here. So I'm getting better at running in the heat here and running pretty well. But I won't rule out the possibility of running a significant personal best, and I'd be very happy with that, of course. And even if I'm close to my personal best, I think that'll hold up pretty well in the results.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's fantastic. We believe that Yuki will be on hand, so we hope you shake his hand before the race. We hope you pull away from a Kenyan at some point.
Yeah. Well, I'll shake Yuki's hand after he crosses the finish behind me.
Okay.
And then we can talk about what marathon we'll run next or something.
And, of course, we'll be on hand to cheer you on in New York, which is where we are. So.
I'm really looking forward to it. New York's going to be a great experience, and it's a great marathon to run. So.
We do have one last question, which is a traditional one that we ask, and that's a selfish one, admittedly. Cloud 259 is a reference to our goal of breaking 3 hours in the marathon. Bren and I have gotten close, but not quite there. We will be on cloud 9 when we get to 259, is what we say. So what would be your top training tip for getting us under 3 hours?
And I'll be doing it at New York, so give me a New York tip, Jeffrey.
Yeah, well, hold back until the Queensboro Bridge.
Right.
Honestly, when it comes to chasing a time goal, and I've learned this in my own personal experience, there's a lot of pressure. When you see a barrier and you have that barrier just in front of you. I mean, definitely it's in reach for you guys. You guys are so close, and I look at 210 the same way, where I'm really close, and you're just kind of running it down. But sometimes you just can't worry about the pace, and you just kind of got to go with the flow of the race. And, if that means going out slower and running a negative split because you feel great, then that's the way to do it. But I think it's so easy in our minds when we have something that's so, so close to us, that it's almost like this mental barrier where if we just find a way to put ourselves in a place where, we're focusing on the race and then another factor, then, the time will come. I mean, it's destined to come because it's so close. And so, you just got to direct your energy into the positive of, moving forward and, going through each mile and maybe running a negative split or maybe just hanging on for dear life that final mile because you're so close. But you just got to, it's just the continued belief that, you're going to get there, and you, you got to have faith and confidence in the work you've done. And, you know, it might just happen when you least expect it. And, you know, you might have, you know, not even considered it being that day, and it will happen. So.
Right. This all sounds to me sort of like don't force it. And I think that it also sounds
like
that Jeanette Faber gave us that I've thought of frequently on Run Since Then that I really like, was just assume that you'll do it. So what I mentioned at the time then, and, you know, I've mentioned again to others, is that it takes the drama out of the race. You know, it's just if you assume you'll do it, it's not an epic struggle to get this thing done. It just, I hope it just puts you in the present moment of the race where you are, you know, basically you're relying on the training that got you there.
It's so easy for us to overthink it and, you know, to overthink a time goal. And, you know, that's wasted nervous energy to do that.
Right.
You have the physical energy to do it. If you rest yourself, you go into the race, you've done the training, you know, you just kind of have to let it flow. And you know, it just is like, yeah, you can't resist it in any way, or, you know, just even that stress of, you know, am I going to break it today or not?
Right,
so,
right.
Well,
Jeffrey, thanks so much. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, my pleasure.
Travels,
thank you both.
And we'll obviously be rooting for you, and we'll help to talk to you again at some point, and we'll see you in New York.
Yeah, sounds fantastic. Thank you guys both again, and I'm a big fan of the show, and, you know, keep up the good work for promoting our sport.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Well, that's great to have three of the six Team USA marathoners, and maybe we'll catch up with the others in the aftermath of Moscow. We hope they all do great.
Yeah, geez, man, a lot to digest there. A lot of great information.
Yep.
And one thing that one project going on in the background here at Cloud 259 is I've been typing up the transcripts of these interviews, so you'll see them pop up every once in a while. We'll get another one done. It takes a while, but hopefully this week we'll get up Dot and Jeanette's at least, so that viewers or listeners who are interested in the world marathons can read our interview as well as listening to it. Probably our preferred way, but I know some people prefer to read than to listen. So there you go.
And we do have the sub-3-hour tips all in one place, a tab on the website, cloud259.com. I think they apply more broadly than just sub-3. If someone's going for sub-4 or sub-2:30, I think they can be applied to anything.
For sure.
Yep.
Finally, one last note on the site. If you hit under the categories on the left, the category podcast, that will give you all of the podcast episodes on one page. I was getting some questions on that. So, Greg, let's stay with the elite scene a little bit and just talk about world champs, maybe finish the circle that we started in our warm-up. On some of these races that we look forward to seeing. We didn't mention in our intro the men's 800-meter race, which I'm really looking forward to, and which, I mean, I guess you mentioned it in the chances that U.S. will get medals. Who do you got in that? Do you have Simmons, Solomon, Amon?
Well, it's hard to bet against Amon because he's basically won everything he entered into in the Diamond League series. But Simmons has been coming on strong. He may be peaking at the right time. So, and he finished fourth at the Olympics. Solomon finished fifth, and in an amazing race. Radisha's out, so I think the field has a chance this time without Radisha there. I don't know. You're more of an 800-meter specialist than me. So, what do you think?
I got a dark horse here. I'm going to go with a Frenchman, Pierre Ambroise Boss, and I'm sure I'm messing up his name. He's 21 years old. He was just right on Solomon's tail at the last Diamond League race. I think it's a bit more wide open than people see it. I think Simmons will medal. I don't know what kind of medal. I'm not sure about Solomon. I'm not sure why I'm a little bit reluctant. I think that maybe losing the U.S. Nats for Simmons maybe lit a little fire. or maybe made Solomon a little too confident. I have no idea. I guess I just like the Frenchman for some reason. I think Amon will be tough to beat, but there are so many good 800-meter runners that I think that this could be a bit wide open, and without Rudisha there, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
In the women's 15, do you like Jenny Simpson or Aragawi, who's been winning all the Diamond League races?
I think Aragawi's times have just been remarkable. I think she has a 3:56, if I'm not mistaken, so I'm going to pick her for gold, but root on Jenny for silver. I think she's definitely poised for a medal.
Yeah, I think she's looking strong. I see her as a bronze.
Now, talking just a little bit more about the Mo double, the 10,000 will be the first test, and I believe that is on the 10th, on the Saturday. And it'll be very interesting to see how the strategy plays out, and it's almost been talked about by the competitors in the press. The obvious point being that Mo Farah's finishing kick is so strong that people are going to have to go out earlier, and we talked about it, I think, on the last show about how there are some candidates like Gebre Wet who may be the one, but someone's going to go early and push the pace or go for a PR type pace rather than the typical tactical race. And I think it'll just be so interesting to watch when that happens, how Mo responds, and whether he's able to double. And I personally think that I would take the field over Mo, as much as I would pick Mo maybe as the favorite. I think he has more of a chance of losing than people think. I'm rooting for him though, but I think the Kenyans and the Ethiopians are really going to take it to him early.
I would love to see that. I would love to see a full 10,000 meter hard from the get-go. That would be interesting. It's one of the things I like about the 800 meter races is that that's pretty much what you get. You get people running as fast as they can run on that day. Not always, but most of the time, certainly, since David Rudisha has come along. In the 10,000, though, we've seen a lot of tactical races, and it does seem from the blitz and blurbs that we've read on the Internet that the Ethiopians are going to push the pace, unlike at London, where Mo was able to rely on his kick. And looking at Mo's 1,500 time, why would you choose any other strategy?
Mm-hmm.
I will take Mo, though. I think that we're in the Mo Farah era. I think I take him over the field. I think that he is what Kenenisa Bekele was for a while, and what Hisham El-Garouj was before then, sort of the one distance runner on the track who is just completely dominant, who blots out the sun. I find it interesting that Bernard Lagat has spanned all three of these eras. You know, he competed with Hisham El-Garouj and also with Bekele, and has also had some good races against Farah. So, as I mentioned in the intro, again, I'll be watching Lagat closely. This may be the last chance we get to see him at a World Championships competition, though I kind of wish, I thought this last year at the Olympics, and I still wish this were true, that he were doing the 10,000, not just the 5,000. I think that Lagat in the 10,000 would be interesting, and perhaps he'll do the 10,000 at the 2015 World Track Champs in Beijing, mm-hmm. if he's still into running on the track at age 40.
Mm-hmm.
I did read a tweet from Lagat recently that made that less a possibility, I suppose. He tweeted, "If only I were younger, the 1500 mile will always be my favorite." So maybe he hasn't done the 10,000 simply because he doesn't want to.
Interesting.
Anything else on the worlds you want to add, Greg?
No, we'll make sure to watch as much as we can, and we'll maybe put some things up on the site. But we'll be tweeting a lot, so if any listeners want to follow us at Cloud259 blog or at Cloud259 blog, we'll put some tweets up. But it'll be very exciting all the way around. It'll be exciting 9 days. So let's
sure.
turn
and
from
we
the
won't,
elite
we won't get one next year, so enjoy it while you have it. These
right.
Worlds happen every other year, so every fourth year we get neither a Worlds nor an Olympics.
Right.
All right, now on to the plebeian level, our own training. Greg, how's training going? What's the plan?
Training's going pretty well. We're getting a little more mileage. I'm declaring for both of us that a month ago, we said that 50 was the new 40, meaning 50 miles should be the baseline. And with an exception here and there, we've held to that. I got to 60 last week, and I'm declaring 60 the new 50. I think we need to ramp it up. And,
I like it.
And so I got there, and if I do it this week and I'm off to a good start, that'll be my first back-to-back week of 60s I think I've ever had, so that'll be good. I ran a double on Monday, and that was a total of 17 miles, which to me is amazing, but to Jeffrey Eggleston, that would be a light day.
Yeah.
If you do the math, 17 miles a day is about, I think it's about 120 a week or something, and that's...
Right, we had Jeanette Shamos telling us she'd been running 90, and she was a little bashful about that, and Dots runs 110, and Jeffrey now 150 miles a week, so...
So,
it really shouldn't be a problem, should it?
Right.
Now, how about how is your body holding up to all this? Because, you know, one thing about doing high volume is that your body's got to be able to handle it. And the most important thing in terms of marathon training is not getting injured, I think, before the race.
You know, luckily, this is what I'm most happy about. It's not feeling worse for the wear. It feels, and this has happened before, like that I'm at 60 miles, mid-50s, I feel actually a little bit better than 40 a week or 35 a week. There's something about just running more often that kind of lubricates the system somehow. So I feel good. I'm not necessarily fast, and we'll get to that in our recent race report, but I feel pretty good.
That's great. And Hartford is just a bit more than 9 weeks away.
Yeah, you put that in our little show notes, and I kind of got scared, and a lump in my throat came up. So thanks for that. I didn't realize it was nine-plus weeks. But
I think the cement 60 is the new 50, and next week I'm declaring that 70 is the new 60. So
yep, that's the goal.
To get serious about the volume. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that Club Champs race. Why don't you go first?
Yeah, well, for those who don't know, in New York there's a race in Central Park, a New York Roadrunners race, a prestigious one for all of the clubs or the teams in the area. Central Park Track Club is one. That's our team. NYAC, New York Athletic Club, of which Jeffrey Eggleston is a member and MEB is a member. Thankfully, they don't show and ruin our parade. But the NYAC has a bunch of great runners, and there are lots of other teams. That's a 5-miler in Central Park. And I really want to get to your report because you had an awesome race. I had a pretty good one. I'm happy with a 32 even. It's not a PR, and it's actually a little bit slower than my 10K PR. But it's headed in the right direction in terms of my races earlier in the year. And if you do the McMillan calculator, which I do all the time, it translates to a 3:08 marathon. So I still have some improving to do in terms of my race results. So use them as tests, and so the test is showing get back to work. But how about your race?
Get back to work. I like the message. I'll talk about my race in a second. I'll just say a note on your running generally from what I've witnessed. I believe that the longer the race, the stronger you do. From training anyways, when Greg and I have run together, Greg runs at a pretty good clip. So I think that in races, I can sort of count on some track speed that I developed from running track. I have a bit of a track background in high school. But in the longer stuff, I think that you're able to sustain. So I think the McMillan calculator is biased in the wrong direction for you. At any rate, I think being serious about training now is obviously the right thing to do, with Hartford just 9 weeks away and New York just 12 weeks away. The Club Champs race, I ran 29:19. I was happy about that because it was a 5-mile race. It was my best time for a 5-mile race since college. I've got about a minute to slice off of that to get back to where I was as a 20-year-old at Swarthmore College back in the mid-1990s. But I don't think that's out of the realm of possibility. And it was a fun race. The second mile felt great. I was tried to just cruise for 2 miles, start really working. And the third mile, I obviously pushed it, and that's when I felt the clock ticking on on how much longer I was going to feel good, because when you start pushing it, sometimes you realize that there might be an end to the energy that you have. The last mile of that race was downhill, and I felt kind of fried, and I was doing all I could to go as fast as I could, and it was my fastest mile of the race, so I suppose that the marathon fitness is helping me out here. Also, I think training in the heat has helped us out. We had a week where it was, you know, over 90 degrees, and Greg and I got out there. This was during bad water. We had no excuses and did a few runs in the heat, and I think that being acclimated to 90 degrees made 70 degrees feel, for me anyways, not as bad as it otherwise might. And I certainly look forward to, you know, 50 degree-ish weather for runs in the fall. So it was a decent race. The McMillan calculator had me at 2:52, but I don't think that really means much, because I think I trend in the opposite direction of you, Greg. I think that the shorter the race, the better I am relatively. You know, my mile time right now is probably faster in the McMillan calculator than my 5 mile time. But it was good, and it was fun just to run the Club Champs. I had never run that race before. That race is only for runners who are in clubs in New York City, so you get the best runners. You get a very competitive field, and it felt good to mix it up and to see some, you know, some familiar names and faces, not only on our club but on some of the other clubs. If I keep running, I'd like to run that one again sometime. It was a good one. But I do think there's still a lot of improvement that I would like to make. I would like to feel more fit and to be able to run a lot faster before the marathon comes around. And finally, that, you know, it's the long runs that I really got to get serious about now. I've gotten up to 9 miles at marathon pace, but I would like to get up to, you know, what many of our earlier guests were talking about, 15 or 16 miles at marathon pace. All right, enough about our training. I'm going to take us to the library now. This will be a quickie, but we're going to go to the photo archives. In doing a little research for our guest tonight, Jeffrey Eggleston, I came across a website called TullyRunners.com, and we'll put this in the show notes, TullyRunners.com. And there were some pictures, some high school track pictures from quite a while ago. The Hobart Invitational in February 2003, there were pictures of that. And in one of those pictures, there was Jeffrey Eggleston as a Greece Arcadia runner. He was in second place at the time, ended up winning the race, and his time was 4:28.08. I think that the picture was very interesting to me because at first, here's a high school picture of the guy we're going to interview. And then we got a picture from Jeffrey that we're going to put on the site to accompany our podcast. And he has the exact same pose in the picture that he sent us as he did in high school. So from my untrained eye, he's got great form. He did in both photos. But also when I was just sort of clicking around that site a bit, I came across some photos of Lopez LeMong, because Lopez LeMong was also running in that general area. He was running actually at Tully in 2003. There's a picture of him in the boy, from the boys' New York State Championship from 2003, running the 1600. And what was interesting to me about this picture was that he was actually in fourth place. He finished fourth in that race, and he looks like he's stuck in the mud. He really looks like he's struggling. So I think for high school runners out there, there were three high school runners that beat LeMong in that race. Eggleston, though he won the race that he was pictured in, he didn't win a lot of those other races back then. You don't have to light the world on fire in high school to end up a professional runner, I guess was my takeaway from it. You just, if you enjoy it, just keep at it, and the improvement will come. You know, not everyone's going to be a pro runner for sure. It's not easy at all, as we've made clear on this show. But it was interesting to see that these guys, LeMong and Eggleston, you know, in some heats, LeMong was not even in the seated heat or the fast heat. So it's not like you've got to be, you know, born running 4 minute miles. On to the soapbox, Greg, take it away. Something premium potties. What are just, premium potties?
Just first, my takeaway from that site or that.
Sure.
is that I'm glad that our high school days predate the internet. So, no pictures of us. I wasn't running, but I was playing basketball, and you can't find it on the internet, and that's a good thing. So my soapbox is premium potties. I was inspired today by an email I got from the Rock and Roll Philly Marathon, which is September 15th. And the subject line is Go Premium with Private Potties, Catered Brunch, and More. So even though it turns out I can't run the race that day, premium potties caught my eye, so I just had to click and investigate. It seems that for an upgrade fee of $45, you can, quote, start race morning right with hot coffee and light refreshments, access to private potties, and a private gear check at the start. Refuel after the race, I'm still quoting, and enjoy your Michelob Ultra finisher's beer with a post-race brunch. And I clicked around, and there's no detailed information about what a premium potty is. So that was my first question. Is it like something that movie stars use on location with slices of brie cheese and crackers sitting on a marble countertop? We need to know. In general, I think you may find this is pretty innocuous, but I think there's a risk that it could be the start of something very, very evil. As we all know with airlines, a premium perk offered to the elites becomes something taken away to the masses, from the masses. Now, I'm no communist, but I've observed that those extra inches they sell for premium economy class, which sounds like an oxymoron, and it is, that they take those inches away from the not-so-premium proletariat class. If you let a certain group on a plane first under elite access or whatever they call it, that just means the rest of the poor sats have to wait a little longer. So I'm warning you, this could happen at marathons and half marathons. You have premium potties now, and it's a matter of time before the regular potties lose their air fresheners or their hand sanitizer.
Oh, come on. They could get worse.
And I thought... And I've thought of a few more awful trends that could be on the horizon. And here are a bunch. One, premium lanes, which are roped off from and wider, offering less congestion at the start of a race. Premium photos for those who don't want to look like they're dying at mile 22. Premium water, extra filtered and handed out by volunteers in white gloves.
With electrolytes.
Right. Premium goo in flavors like creme brulee or saffron lychee nut. Premium cheering sections, especially good for runners whose loved ones are thousands of miles away. Premium pacemakers, who not only run perfect splits like Jeffrey Eggleston, they also elbow aside other runners who talk too loud or have annoying conversations. And lastly, how about a premium finish with a special finisher's tape for people to break no matter what their time or finishing positions, followed by a premium rubdown and maybe even a premium poncho. And let's not forget that premium beer, the Michelob Ultra.
Oh.
So if anybody wants to email us with additional premium amenities at races, we're at cloud259@outlook.com, or you can click contact us on the website, and there's a link to an email address there.
That is a very disturbing message. Certainly some of your examples were in jest, but I don't know. I mean, that is disturbing. I mean, you brought up the airlines, and, you know, already with the baggage, you know, the security with the baggage is a little bit over the top. Premium toilets, I don't like that one bit.
I'm just curious what they look like. I may have to, in the name of journalism, I may have to investigate. So
like buying access to races, I don't know. You know, there was that a few years ago. There was one of the NYR races. There was a guy who was probably not even our ability, right in the middle of the elites at the start. Do you think
had he tipped one of the volunteers or something?
I think he donated a whole lot of money.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that'll do it. So
at any rate, I think, thanks, Greg. I find that quite ominous. thank you, everybody, for listening so much. Thanks most to Jeffrey Eggleston, who joined us. We are not worthy. I'll try to finish within an hour of him at New York City. maybe if I can crack three, it'll be within 50 minutes, 55 minutes, who knows. But we'll be watching them in the Worlds. We will record our next episode in a few weeks, but we will be updating the website and the tweets, so check our tweets. And we look forward to hearing from some of you and seeing some of you at some point. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the cloud.